So we're really delighted and pleased to have met Chandler Saint and to promote this fascinating book entitled Venture Smith. It is a project which includes an extraordinary autobiography by an African American who was enslaved, came to purchase his freedom, and wrote his autobiography, which is considered a really extraordinary document, one of less than 20 autobiographies from the first 200 years of the American colonies. Chandler Saint is with us today to give us an overview of Venture Smith's life and his work as co-director of the Documenting Venture Smith Project. Chandler Saint has, originally studied art, as life would have it, came to meet many extremely influential civil rights workers, civil rights activists of the day, who influenced him and set him on another course of work and study and passion. He's been active preserving early American buildings and artifacts. He's a founder and president of the Beecher House Center for the Study of Equal Rights. And the Venture Smith Project really has become a passion of Mr. Saint. He's based in Connecticut and has been very gracious to come to us this afternoon and speak to us about Venture Smith, who did spend some time here on Long Island, as well as in Connecticut and Rhode Island. So as you'll find out, his autobiography describes life for an enslaved person and then a freed black man in the New England area during the colonial period. So please now give a very, very warm welcome to Chandler Saint.
Thanks, Marianne. The Documenting Venture Smith Project was launched in September 2005. Informally, we had been, three of us had been working on it for 3 or 4 years beforehand. 2005 was the 200th anniversary of Venture Smith's death. And it was launched by Professor David Richardson, founding director of the Wilberforce Institute for the Study of Slavery and Emancipation in Hull in the UK, and one of the co-authors of the slave voyage documentation that's housed down at Emory University. Effectively, David Richardson, David Eltis, with a few others, have documented 38,000 of the Atlantic World voyages. They feel that they've done 85% of all the voyages that occurred in the to both North and South America. And back in 2005, David was at Yale on a seminar, and he and I were together doing something called Lane Debates. And then we started looking at a couple of the sites, and David Richardson Eltis came to the conclusion that Venture might be the seminal person to tell the story of Atlantic slavery, certainly for the British. And so we launched the project, which was everybody else thought that David and I were talking about a one-year project. We kind of laughed quietly to ourselves, and we went back to the very beginning. And over the last 14 years, it's become the largest project. It's an interdisciplinary project. We have standard historians. David Richardson's an economic historian, which really helps. We've had archaeologists. We had a philosopher. We opened Venture's family gravesite in East Haddam. We have a DNA project, not going backwards, but going forward to how these things will look in the future. And it's generated now about, I think, 5 books, a CD, 5 C-SPAN shows. And I finished a year, just a little, yeah, it's just About a year and a half ago, a bunch of 1785 to 95 documents appeared that nobody had seen before, and they were handwritten records by a probate judge in a justice of the peace in Haddam, Connecticut. And it kind of threw everything upside down. We had done with a man named George Krimsky, and he and I had done two books before. These documents answered a lot of the outstanding questions. So, and George had just died. So I sat down and hid away for 3 months and rewrote the book and then typeset it. And Marianne, we worked really hard to make sure we would not make money. That's why it's... What we realized, my first book was published by University Press, and when I was doing this, we said, well, we wanted like a $12 or $14 book, and the editor of the press said, how are we going to make money? And everybody in the Venture Smith Project looked at her and said, well, we're not going to make money. And then we went down, and our goal is to put Venture Story into schools and all, and we felt we got a lot of feedback from university history professors, and they all said, if you have a reference book and it's under $10, we'll recommend it to our students. When it becomes a $15 to $25 book, we don't recommend it anymore because they can't afford it. We can put these into schools and libraries for our cost is under $6. So far in the last year, we've done every Connecticut library we've donated a book to. We're in the middle, actually, of tacking out here. We have the Equiano Scholar sponsored 40 of the Suffolk County libraries to the west, and we're looking for somebody with $219 to do the 25 on the east end. And we're working so far in the last 6 months, I think we've taken 400 books into Ghana, into the schools, and we're in the process with former President Kufuor of translating the narrative into Fonti, the language of Anamabu, where Venture left Africa in 1739. So if the book got expensive, we knew that we were closing off the school issue. But it sometimes, Marianne's right, I really wish I was making money. To start, Venture was born as Brotir Furo approximately January 1st, 1729. That's the date he came up with in the 1790s when he was designing his tombstone. At that point, he wanted to be buried as a Connecticut gentleman, a peer of his community. So he even needed a date of birth or an age. And he clearly worked back as many events as he could, and I think he's, you know, give or take a year or so, he's got it dead right. And he picked January 1st, 1729. And he was born probably in a place called Uangara that does not exist. It's basically where Chad, Niger, Nigeria, and northern Cameroon come together near the Lake of Chad. Unfortunately, none of us can go there because Venture's probably born within 25 to 50 miles of the headquarters of Boko Haram. And I can't get anybody that will take me there. He was being raised to be the leader of his people, so he would have, by age one or so, been full-time tutored and educated. By late 1738, a man named King Bukhara begins a jihad going across the sub-Sahara trading route, knocking off little countries, capturing livestock, gold, and people. And he's doing exactly, ironically and sadly, exactly what Boko Haram is doing today, where you go in, you kill off all the men and the boys because they're trouble. You take the women and the girls, and Boko Haram traffics them into the sex trade. And that's why when you see the headlines that talks about the massacres in the village, what they're really doing is eliminating all resistance. And the same thing happened to Venture's father and all. He was then marched 1,000 miles across northern Nigeria, Togo, Benin, to the Gold Coast of what is now Ghana, and down to the port of Anamabu. You hear about Cape Coast and Elmina. Anamabu was, unfortunately, the port of choice for the New England slavers. So Venture came out of Africa at the place, probably guesses are like 40% of all the slaves that come into New England in the 18th century would have come out of there. It only operated for effectively as a trading post for 100 years. But Anamabu, unlike Cape Coast, which was an administrative headquarters, and the same with Elmina, Anamabu was built for one purpose, to strip people of their freedom, their identity, and to buy and sell human beings. Between 1707 and 1807, almost 500,000 Africans lost their freedom at Anamabu. So what basically every hour of every day, 7 days a week, for 100 years from dawn to dusk, every hour an African lost his freedom at the fort of Anamabu, which puts it up. And in that 100-year period, Anamabu exceeds Cape Coast and Elmina combined for 350 years. Venture arrived there sometime in the spring of 1738. He was around 11 years old. We know that he had already, when his country was captured, he saw his father killed. He had already passed the rights to adulthood, even though, you know, people think of it. We have a great problem, like when I go into schools and talk to them, they say, well, he's a 10-year-old kid. And I say, well, Henry VIII's son was only 9 and he went to the throne. Jonathan Edwards, the great theologian in Connecticut, was just turning 13 when he entered Yale. And at that point, he was fluent in English, Latin, Greek, working on his Hebrew and his French. He was just turning 17 when he graduated as valedictorian. So at Venture, in the runaway notice in 1754, it describes he had tribal scarifications of his face, which would have been part of his passage to adulthood. So when he was captured, he had been educated. The other one is people I get in schools, well, it's interior of West Africa, and I point out, well, the trade route went to Timbuktu. And at the time Venture was there, Timbuktu's library exceeded all of North America. I mean, it was one of the three or four great libraries of the whole world. So it's a sophisticated, educated area. And as I say, he was then sold to the mate of a Rhode Island ship called the Charming Susanna. We believe the Susanna is the name of the wife and the mother of a Barbados merchant who probably owned a third of the boat, and he named his slave ship after his wife. That would get you in trouble today. But for Robinson Mumford was out of the Mumford clans of Rhode Island and eastern Connecticut. They were major traders, shippers, from New London over to Newport. Robinson was 20 years old. He bought Venture, we believe, to be his manservant. Robinson and Venture clearly bonded on the voyage over. Venture spends around 1740 in Newport with Robinson's, one of Robinson's sisters, learning, probably learning English, learning customs and how to behave and how to ultimately become this manservant. He's taken to Fisher's Island, which was the George, Captain George Mumford's, leased it, and basically in 1740s, Fisher's Island was a provisioning plantation for the West Indies. And most people think of, you know, when I was in school, we were taught about this triangle and we were up there. Well, you got to turn the triangular down in eastern Connecticut. Our job was growing the foodstuff to feed the slaves of Barbados and Jamaica. The land in Barbados was too valuable to grow food on. So you had your big plantations in Salem, Connecticut. The Brown Plantation was 9,800 acres. Fisher's Island was 2,300. Shelter Island was 8,500. And that's what these places were. The Mumfords, when we first started the project and we went out to Fisher's Island, they explained to us that George Mumford and his wife and their two kids lived there, and they had a little domestic help. And I started digging in the records, and I got a wonderful collection in 1754 when George moved to the mainland, and I found, I can give you the names of 14 of the domestic help, and I think I've got six more and maybe two more. And I went back, the next time we went to Fisher's Island, said, gee, this is a really great house. Four people, and they got like 14 to 18 domestic help. that does not add up. But obviously, the biggest crop they had, the biggest thing, were the sheep. And as we know, islands are the perfect place to raise sheep. Don't need any fences or anything. They don't go anywhere. Venture arrived with Robinson. Unfortunately, a year afterwards, Robinson dies at sea. And Venture is taken out of the house and put out into the fields with the rest of the hands. He's on Fisher's. He gets married to a woman named Margaret. And unfortunately for the family and all we know is she has a Dutch name. We know that shortly after he marries, Venture runs away, probably trying to set up a place and then come back and get her. This is his first time of engaging with Long Island. He, two other slaves, and an indentured Irish servant steal a boat and provisions. They get to Montauk Point, and they're headed to one of the few typos in Venture's 1798 narrative. The printer realized he didn't know how to spell it, and Venture was referring to the Massapequa River, which comes from Oyster Bay down, and he put in Mississippi. And it bothered a lot of us for a long time. Venture, in 1754, Venture is now fully grown. He's 6 feet one and a half, weighs somewhere between 250 and 300 pounds, tribal scarifications. And at that point, the average person is about 5'6". If you're a runaway slave in New England in the mid-18th century, normally you go to New York and hide out there. If you're 6 feet one and a half, you're not hiding out. You're going to be captured and returned quickly. The only places to go is to go and live with Native American tribe. That's clearly what Venture, and that's what most of the Long Island Native American people we've worked with all believe that, yeah, Venture's wife too, Margaret, was probably a slave, and whether second or third generation Native American, and probably from that tribe, and that's where Venture was headed. As I say, they got to Montauk. The Irishman runs off on them. The whole thing falls apart, and Venture does his first very brilliant move. He comes over as far as, with the help of some people from Southampton, recaptures the Irishman, and Venture takes the Irishman and turns and sails back to Fisher's Island and turns him in, and hopes for the best. At the end of 1754, his first child, his daughter, is born. George Mumford is retiring. He's 65. They sell Venture to the Stantons on Stonington Point, and you immediately see one of the great crimes of slavery. Venture goes there. Meg and his daughter go to New London, and the family separated. A year later, the Stantons then buy Venture's wife and his and two children, but the crime was there. Venture spends about 4 years with him. He and the Stantons definitely do not get along. Really unpleasant. Stanton wants to get rid of him. 1759 is Venture's first really big break. He gets pawned to a lawyer in Hartford, Connecticut, Daniel Edwards. Daniel Edwards was Jonathan Edwards' uncle, but had been his roommate for undergraduate and graduate at Yale. He was ordained and then went into the law. When Venture comes there, he's almost 60. He has one of the fanciest houses in Hartford. He's a major figure. In 10 years, the state librarian and I have found four pieces of paper relating to him. When Venture's living in the house, Daniel Edwards is the probate judge of Hartford. He's a practicing lawyer. He's the Queen's appointment to the upper legislature. He's Governor Trumbull's advisor for financial affairs and the bond writer. And then on the days when he's a little bored, he's one of the Connecticut Supreme Court judges. So you talk about conflict. This guy really covered everything. But Venture lived in this house, was clearly treated by Daniel Edwards. And at that point, while Venture's living in the house in Hartford, and that's one of the first recent breaks we got, Edwards's probate inventory does exist. It was done for his wife. And fortunately, the person that did the inventory books by title. In years dealing this stuff, I never saw an inventory with this kind of detail. And what's really wonderful, at Yale he'd been a tutor. And by God, the books that you would have to teach English are sitting in that library in Hartford. And it was one of the best libraries in Connecticut. So Venture spent a year exposed to a very cultured man who also, his own child was going through a religious conversion. Edwards was actually baptized some slave children in the first church in Hartford and publicly came out for educating them. So he was very open about these issues and clearly had a profound effect on Venture. Up until 1759, everything Venture did was combating or fighting with his owners to try and gain something. After Edwards, he's trying to work agreements, deals, and motivate to improve himself. He leaves Hartford in 1760. Gets sold for the last time to a young man, Oliver Smith, who is from Groton, establishing a business in Stonington. The house that Venture built is for Oliver, is still standing in Stonington. And the other thing is that Oliver Smith and he, Oliver goes into a formal agreement allowing Venture to redeem himself and to pay over time. So when he's not working for his owner, he's working for himself. And the relationship between Oliver Smith and then Venture Smith is pretty interesting, because he comes there in 1760. Sometime around 1761, Venture, while still a slave, buys his first farm. And he buys it on Stonington Point. It's directly next to the Stanton farm, where his wife and kids are still enslaved. It's owned by Oliver Smith's wife's family. And so they allow Venture, their slave, to actually buy a farm and work it during this period while he's buying his freedom. And the relationship between the Smiths in 1765, about the first week in April, Venture finishes earning the money for the redemption contract and regains his freedom that he lost 26 years before. He takes Oliver Smith's name, and it's clear that his relationship with Oliver Smith is giving him access to that extended family structure that any farmer or person needs in New England to survive. Oliver lets him have the name. And Venture and Oliver Smith, although Venture moves here to Long Island, then moves to East Haddam, they stay. And this is, we have no documentation in detail from either man, but clearly these two men figured out how to overcome the issue of owned and owner. For the next 30 plus years, they do business together. I'm not saying that they loved each other, but they developed immense trust. And it carries down inside the family. Venture's youngest son, Solomon, does business with the son of his father's owner, Edmund Smith. And in 1815, 10 years after his father dies, Solomon has a son born, ironically, exactly just about 50 years after his father regained his freedom. And Solomon names the son after his father's owner and George Washington. Now, you don't have people naming their male sons after somebody they don't respect. And along comes this kid, George Oliver Washington Smith. And the name stays in the family all through the 19th century. So we see a pattern of both father and son and all somehow able to do business as late as 1798, when Venture needs and Solomon needs some money. They come from East Haddam all the way over to Stonington, and they borrow money from Oliver Smith's son. So these two families are working together in some really positive manner. Once Venture is free, though, he doesn't go out and celebrate. Because, yeah, he's regained the freedom after 26 years, but he's not free. Economically, he has nothing. And three children and his wife are still enslaved to an owner that he doesn't get along with. Venture, at that point, sells this farm that he'd bought, has a fire, and gets rid of it, and he moves to Long Island. And at some point, he ends up on Ram Island here in Southampton. We don't know the actual date. And the problem we have there is that Ram Island is owned by is part of the Treaty of the Shinnecocks. So, and the first recorded deed and all is in the 1850s. So Venture would have been living on Ram Island with some kind of an agreement. And he says, I acquired a farm on Long Island. And it's some kind of a handshake agreement between honorable men, Venture and the Shinnecocks. And obviously it's not recorded in the town hall, so I can't give you an exact date. But in his narrative, said Venture says, while working on Ram Island, I redeemed my two sons. What becomes more interesting that we've just literally in the last few weeks been playing with on this is the economics of slave labor and all. While Venture is working in the winters, while he's owned by Oliver Smith and Stoney between 1760 and 65, he's either paying Oliver for the privilege of going out and working on his own, or giving him the percentage of the money he earns. Venture, and then working his day off and all. Venture is takes about 4.5 years to collect some roughly 50 pounds to buy his freedom, working 6 months of the year in the winter. Not 50, I'm saying 40. And when you run it out, he's actually able to save about 2 pounds a month. He gets to Long Island, and clearly he comes over here because at that point the opportunity for him to do business and all is better than it is over in Stonington. Venture shifts from being a manual laborer, immediately selling the wood he cuts or the grain he harvests and taking that money and immediately paying it to Oliver to become free. And he becomes this phenomenal businessman. He's a producer. He's fishing. He's cutting wood. Like in the winter, the last winter when he was free over here, he cut 400 cords of wood in less than 6 months and split it. That's a lot of wood to do in the winter for one guy with an axe. And he describes on Ram Island, he's doing eeling, he's doing lobstering. But he also realizes that he wants more than just producing this stuff. And at the end of his life, he talks about all the boats and things he owned and the trading. He goes whaling one period for Oliver on the boat. He goes, he'll go off and buy a load of clams from one guy here and haul them up into Connecticut. He becomes a producer, a distributor, and a trader. And he's trying to capture every part from the planting of the seed to the baking of the bread and the profit. And he's very much like a modern corporate farmer. And when we just recently played with the numbers, it's really interesting. All of a sudden, instead of 2 pounds a month, in less than 4 years, Venture earns over 300 pounds here. A staggering amount of money. Now, obviously, this is an extremely motivated man. He wants his children free. He wants his wife back with him. And he is driven. But effectively, by becoming this businessman, which somehow it seems he's allowed to do here on Long Island, he is amassing more than 6 pounds a month after all his expenses and living and everything. So once he becomes a sort of entrepreneur, and then when he, late in 1774, he's succeeded in freeing his sons, is in the middle of the deal on his wife and his daughter, and he's freed a couple other Africans. He's put the money up so that they can be free, and then they can pay back the cost without interest to him over a period. He sees the war coming. He's clearly remembers seeing his father killed and his country wiped out, and he decides he isn't going to be here in Long Island when the British arrive. And at that point, his family's free, he has money, he's been sailing in the ocean. This is a man that could build a boat, put his family in it, could sail back to Africa, could go to Nova Scotia with the Tories, could go to England, The only choice that doesn't seem to appeal to him is being where a war is going to be, or go back to Connecticut with the mass exodus. And Venture picks East Haddam, Connecticut, where the two general champions are from Westchester and East Haddam. It's the supply center of the American Revolution. And he buys, goes over, he works for a little bit, and instead of taking his wages from the man, he takes land. And Venture starts betting at the time of the American Revolution on on land, which is a symbol of freedom. And between the beginning of 75 and the end of the war, he amasses almost 140 acres. The fishing rights on the Salmon River, which is a tributary of the Connecticut River, and major fishing rights, and which he owns jointly with a prominent white businessman in the area. He has a dry dock there, we found from the archaeological. He has storage sheds, and it's this funny little tributary up there where it's very defensible. Nobody's going to see what's going on. You go right around the cove, and so where all the people are, nobody can see whether Venture's unloading tax-exempt goods or regular goods or what. He has the farm. He's doing all kind of farming, and he's doing shipping. He's doing the wood trade to Rhode Island, and he's clearly going back and forth to Long Island. He builds three houses, somewhere between three to five barns, and these storage units in this dry dock. Venture's farm site on Haddam Neck is a pristine archaeological site. It had the advantage of 50 years ago, they put in a nuclear power plant. And you can put up a wall or real fencing and concertina wire and you can't keep anybody out. You string a little piece of just straight wire and hang a yellow and black sign on it that says radiation hazards. And that's all that was around this 500 acre site, and nobody went on it in all those years, because all of Venture's farm site has these yellow and black signs, says radiation hazards. 32 acres of it now belong to the federal government, and that's been a pristine archaeological site. His first farm that he owned as a slave and then bought it, a larger version later in the 1770s. In the mid-1770s, Venture had a farm in Stonington, Connecticut, and a farm in the East End. So he was way ahead of most people. So you could say the Stonington one was the weekend one, or the East End one was the weekend one. It's not clear which, but he's going back and forth. His wife and the kids that are still enslaved are living one, and he's living with one of the boys in the other, and getting in their sailboat and canoe and going back and forth across the Sound. That exists as a pristine site. The house exists in Stonington. The fort at Anamabu is basically untouched since the last African stood on the sail block. In the book, you'll see pictures of it. I've been doing a lot in Ghana, because I finally reached the point where I wanted to understand this thing, and I wanted to understand what the crime and what the seminal moment for this 12.5 million people were. And I started going to the fort, and then one morning I got up and went and sat in the holding cell and walked through the fort and the route that would take. Now I can tell you within 50 meters and 2 weeks exactly where Venture left Africa in 1739. We can't do that for almost any other survivor of the Middle Passage. I found a map in the archives in London when, in 1757, the African Trading Company needed money, and they went to Parliament to get money. And it's like, this is, I've, in 40 years of preservation, I've never worked on a building. There out comes this colored map this big. It's got everything drawn on it, and even marks, it says, the point where the canoes left. And it's a full engineering drawing of the fort with elevations and cross sections, all hand colored. And it was the thing to put up in the easel while you're telling the guys. And then the guy wrote 26 pages. And he talks about where he bought the bricks and has 5 years of expenses on this fort. I mean, it's mind-boggling. So that exists clearly. The final thing that we've been doing a lot this year, basically Rob Forbes, who was at Gilder Lehrman, and David Richardson and I, back in 2004, were talking about the narrative. And we recognized the narrative was important. 3 weeks ago, I asked the question of both of them, did you realize how important it was? And both of them said no. We've been doing a lot of what's called data mining of word groups, because basically there's a small group that says that slave narratives, Native American things, but particularly Venture's narrative cannot be trusted because it was dictated to a person and recorded, and that in essence what they're saying is without the help of the benevolent person, this person couldn't have produced the narrative. And that's what happens with the slave things. But Ventures is an actual autobiography. So Rob Forbes did all this data mining where you take 3 to 5 word groups that are descriptive phrases and run them through, and you will see every time they were used in the English printed world in London or here up to 1850. And when you start to see phrase groups that don't appear anywhere else in print, one, no. But when you get a half dozen of them, you realize you have an author. You have somebody with a literary style. And so we started running that through, and they appear throughout the narrative. They're not just in one place, in one page. So, and Venture ends it anyway on the last page. He says, I'm almost blind when I go out. One of my grandchildren has to lead me around, which for the people that say, well, he dictated to somebody else, you know, if you're blind, it really does help to have a scribe. At this point, we're absolutely convinced that Venture, there was a 19th century, 1897 republication with a whole bunch of things by a fairly biased historian, and he claimed it's the scribe. He gave us the name of the scribe that recorded it and the printer. Fortunately, the scribe that he's claiming left a 1,200-page diary, and it's the worst document you've ever seen. All the major slave guys made it through about 60 pages. I made it through 850, but we realized that he had nothing to do with it. Venture was living at home, and there's in the book we take the cover of the Yale copy, which members of the family think is the one that came out of the house in the 1940s and ends up at Yale, and it has corrections of spelling of the African name. So it became clear Venture wrote this autobiography. His grandchildren or his children transcribed it, and they went down to the local printing press, the New London Bee, and paid to have the book printed. And since I wrote the book before this, everybody, even Lonnie Bunch and all the Smithsonian, looked at it and said, you know, you're absolutely right. The previous accepted was R. Nigg in 1858, and they're now agreeing that Venture's narrative, we're moving the date all the way back to 1798 from the antebellum period to the early republic, that Venture's narrative is the first African literary voice known. was written by an African-American, recorded by his family, who helped him edit it, paid for, and printed in the 18th century. And the reason he wrote it became, we were just assuming always that this is a man who believed he's in poor health, he's dying, he knew who he was, he knew what he had done, and he wanted to be remembered. This is just basic human instincts. In 1798, his son Cuff, 95, his son Cuff, the older of the two boys, gets caught stealing in Haddam. That's what these court records showed. He gets flogged, he gets kicked out of the family, and he's not buried in this family plot that Venture had designed as early as 1792. At that point, Venture had been living two worlds. He'd been trying to rebuild what was lost by his father, and he was proud of the of what he had built in the new country here. With the death of, with the banishment of his son, Venture faced the big problem of, under the African culture, what his son had done would mean the family was shunned. Everything that Venture had done would be wiped out for multiple generations. By the local customs, everybody probably, he was loved and revered in the Haddams, would have come up and said, well, you did the best you could. Some kids come out okay and some don't, and you're still our friend and you're still part of the community. And at that point, Venture set out to define himself in the country. In the last page, there's a phrase, my freedom is a privilege which nothing else can equal. And everybody's always assumed that that's a standard Revolutionary War jargon. My freedom is a privilege. And we never checked it until about a month ago. We ran that through, and my freedom is a privilege never appeared in print in North America before Venture's narrative. Venture is the first person to, in print, is one of the first people to define freedom both for himself and the country, and that's what the narrative is about. And that's why it is so important, and that's where we're concentrating a lot of work now. But basically, Venture is, if you get behind him, and he's very hard in that he, if we use 10 words, Venture uses 2, so you have to look behind all the words. He's talking about what freedom meant in Africa to him, but he's then talking about what it took him and the country to build freedom here and what freedom means, and that's his defining thing. And which means that Venture's narrative sits there in this small group with things like Thomas Paine and de Tocqueville, de Crevecoe's Letters from an American Farmer, as one of the defining documents of the early republic and of freedom. And as we said, as Marianne said, there's only 16 recorded published autobiographies in the first 200 years of America, and then you add Venture's. So the narrative, the only thing you can complain about it is it's too short. And that's the sum thing. But outside of that, it's a literary masterpiece, and it's an important document in defining the country, and it happens to be written by an African-American. But more important, it was written by, as he says, a resident of more than 60 years of the United States in 1798. And this, you know, several times he made conscious things. When he left Long Island in 1774, he decided to bet everything on the revolution. And, you know, for him, it didn't come out too bad. I mean, 4-5 years later, he's gone from sort of having a lease thing here to owning 140 acres in the major business. So the promise of economic opportunity that was being afforded to him, that was delivered. You know, he dies in 1805, And venture is, when venture dies, is, you know, we're at that point where the door is about to be closed for African Americans in America. Ventures world, the discrimination was a class and a thing. It wasn't, you know, would he have succeeded in the 19th century under the rules? At first thought you say no, but then when you look at this remarkable man, all you can say is it would have been even harder, and it was obviously unbelievably hard what he went through, but this is a guy that would have succeeded. And that's why we argue every school kid should be reading Venture's narrative. And for the last 6 months, I've been working with them, with the former president, John Kufuor, in Ghana, and he wants it now. He wants every Ghanaian. That's why we're going to start translating it into them next week. In 4 days, we're actually putting my book in the, it's going to be required reading for every school kid in Anamabu, where Venture left Africa. Vince Coretta, the Equiano scholar, just paid for sponsoring books for all the public, private, and religious schools in Ghana, so they circulate around. So all the kids in Anamabu, where Venture left, will read this story and become familiar with it.